Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We're broadcasting from the campus of the University of California, Irvine, and we are on the internet at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and business of writing. And the opinions you hear today are not those of the University of Regents at UCI, but those of me and my guest, Thomas Fox Averill. He is my guest today, fortunately so. He's the author of two story collections and a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He's an O. Henry Award winner and writer in residence and professor of English at Washburn University. He's also author of Secrets of the Chill Cafe, and I don't know that I'm pronouncing it right, but he can straighten me out when we bring him on. It's published by Blue Hen Books, an imprint of Penguin Putnam. The book is also a finalist in the IACP Literary Food Writing category of the Cookbook Contest, and his next novel, The Slow Air of Ewan McPherson, will be published by Blue Hen and will see publication in 2003. Hi, Thomas.
Hello, how are you?
Great to talk.
Yes, good to talk with you finally.
Please pronounce the title so that I don't botch it up.
Well, I'm not sure that I don't botch it up too, but I call it The Secrets of the Chill Cafe.
All right.
It's a Hopi word, and it's based on the Chill Katina. And I think the Hopi say Kachina as Katina, Katsina, something like that. So
interesting.
So that's how I say it.
Well, I love novels with recipes, and yours certainly has them. Tell me about the structure of the book, how it came about.
Well, it's really interesting because the book, for me, did not come first out of literary endeavor at all. It really came out of food. And so I've been cooking the book for a really long time before actually sitting down to write the book. The book sort of started in 1992, and you'll remember that was the 500th anniversary of the Columbus voyage.
Yes.
And there was so much about Columbus and so much about European discovery that after a while I thought, who cares about European discovery? Why not think about what the people in the Americas, in the Western Hemisphere before Columbus, discovered and made use of? And the best example of that I could think of was the centuries-long relationship they'd had with plants and animals so that they could survive.
Mm.
And so I started researching the foods and just getting interested in what the New World, what the Western Hemisphere tasted like, just all by itself. So I actually was starting to do some cooking just using, you know, the sort of main ingredients of the Western Hemisphere. That would be turkey, that would be corn, that would be tomatoes, potatoes, green beans, pinto beans, black beans, peanuts, and, of course, chilies. One of my favorite, the hot stuff. And I began researching that food and cooking with it and did that for years and really just out of a sort of passion for it. I found as a writer that whatever I do, I have to follow a passion. And so that was my passion until someone said, well, are you writing down the recipes? And I said, yes, I am. And what are you going to do? Oh, I don't know. And someone said, well, you should start a restaurant. And I thought, no, you know, I'm an English professor. I know people who are in the restaurant business. It's a terrible business, a very hard business
right, to
be in. And but that sort of kicked me into thinking, well, I know the restaurant I could create. It would be a fictional restaurant.
Interesting.
And so I could have sort of my double in the kitchen, Robert Hingler, and I could marry him to an old world food type of person, Maria Tito from the Hill, Italian Catholic area of St. Louis, and have a boy growing up between these two intense people with their intensity about food, and that's really where it started.
Interesting. Had you written about food before?
Yeah, I've written several stories that contained food, and especially one called Spicy Food that was in my collection called Seeing Mona Naked. So I've been interested in food for a long time and been an avid gardener as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's unusual, of course, to have a man writing a book that has recipes in it. I mean, it's certainly a masculine book, but do you know what I mean?
Oh, sure.
I just found that just a wonderful aspect of the book.
Well, I've always cooked. From the time that I realized in college that my roommates would do the dishes if I would cook. And I was not a very sophisticated cook, but I was always interested in food. And then when I began gardening, I got more interested in food. And read a lot of cookbooks. My mother was a wonderful cook, and my father was a wonderful consumer of food. So yeah, I came from an eating family. And I guess because I always cooked and I always enjoyed reading food books, especially ones that had recipes in them, that I went ahead and tackled it as a project, even though I realized, most of those books that I was inspired by, Ruth Reichel's Tender at the Bone or Like Water for Chocolate, mm-hmm. were all books about women and their relationships to food. And in some ways, I guess I sort of had a tendency to masculinize Robert Hingler and his interest in food. He's a pretty strict guy about his food,
yes.
And he's kind of macho about his food, too. Although his son, Wes, whom I probably identify with more, is really trying to negotiate the world between all kinds of food, not just his father. So.
And it's an intense book, too. It's not, it's hearing that there are recipes in it, one might think that it's a light story and it's all very cute and precious, and it's kind of intense. There are some incredibly intense scenes in this book.
Yeah, I tried to make it realistic to a family. I mean, in some ways, it's really a story of a family. And the food becomes a kind of metaphor for the family, for the differences between the parents, for the intensities of the parents, and for how Wes negotiates his path in between them. And much of it is family material. The kind of the secrets of the Till Cafe are culinary secrets in part, but only in part. And then, of course, there's the usual intensities and hardships of growing up and realizing your parents are human beings and that you are too, and that there are things you don't know about yourself, and that's the one thing I like about the title, the idea of the secrets. It has that sort of double meaning. Plus, the reader always knows when you have secrets in the title that you're going to get the secrets.
Mm.
It's the same word as secrete, after
all. That's true. Now, is this the title you started out with?
No. I started out with the title Allspice.
Interesting.
Because of the actual plant Allspice, but also because there was so much spice in the book. But it's sort of a bland title in some ways. I mean, it suggests the everything of the food in the book, but I like the title that we settled on better.
Yeah. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Thomas Fox Averill, author of Secrets of the Chill Cafe, published by Blue Hen Books. Will you read to us?
I'd love to. Maybe, if it's okay, just a bit from the very first.
Sure.
Because one of the challenges I had in writing about food was that you write one word at a time, but you eat with all your senses at once. And I was interested in sort of establishing with the reader each of the parents and each of their attitudes towards talk and also towards taste. And so my very first chapter, I've got just a very brief section with the mother and Wes, and then the father and Wes, and you sort of see the differences between them, and just read.
Yes.
Quickly. My crib and then my bed were in my mother's kitchen, where she spent most of her time. Sunshine streamed into her southern windows and onto her plants, pots, pans, bottles, and jars, and on her cookbooks, shelves of them. The bottom shelf, though, was mine. By the time I was 3, I had learned that my mother would stop almost anything if I asked her to read me a book. I would run to that bottom shelf and pull out Winnie the Pooh, and we would read the adventures of Christopher Robin, Pooh, Piglet, and the rest. My mother was a tall woman, and I loved jumping into her lap, being engulfed by her arms, looking at the pictures and the words. Her long braid was often curled around her shoulder, and I sometimes held it, pretending it was Eeyore's tail. One day, when we were reading Pooh, my mother pointed to the word honey. "This is a word, Wes," she said. "It says honey." She stood up, leaving me to sit on the kitchen chair. "But it isn't honey. It's only a word. You know what honey really is, don't you? She took down her honey jar and brought two spoons. Let's taste this word, she said. She dipped a spoon in the honey and brought it out, twirling it in the sunlight. The honey glowed. She put it in my mouth where it was warm and golden and sweet, and where it coated my tongue and melted into my throat. Mothers make milk for their babies, said my mother. I made milk for you. And bees make honey for their babies, Wes. Those are the only two natural foods made only to be eaten. They're not anything else, not seeds, not flowers, not fruits, not leaves, not roots. They're food, food alone. I want some milk, I said, and we drank. Milk and honey, she said. When you're a child, you live in the land of milk and honey. Can we taste other words, I asked. From then on, when we read, we tasted words. With Mother Goose, we had a little nutmeg and a golden pear. We ate Peter Piper's pickled peppers from my mother's jars of pepperoncinis and cherry peppers. Once we were pumpkin eaters like Peter. And like Jack Horner, we put plums on our thumbs and said I was a good boy. We even ate lamb, though my mother insisted it was not Mary's little lamb. We stopped short of 4-20 blackbirds. And then Wes is with his father as well, and his attitude towards food.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I watched him make tamales. And while he worked, he talked about the time that he'd bought an old car and traveled the back roads looking for the unusual, the taqueria with beef tongue tacos, the honey pinion candies, the Indian reservations where they still ate dogs. The mouth can talk, he said, but tasting is first. Talk is just the translation. And he put some cactus filling in my mouth. It's spicy, I said. Don't talk, taste, he said. I let the chili heat subside and tasted the other flavors and textures, the hearty tomato, the sweet corn, the crunch of prickly pear cactus. It's not spicy, I said. That's my boy, he said. When you taste, things just are what they are. Well, what's the name of the hot, I asked. Chipotle, he said. He went to a jar in his kitchen and brought me a dark, shriveled pepper the size of my little finger. Smell it, he said. Smoke, I said. That's right. It's a smoke-dried red jalapeno, chipotle. And chipotle, I said. Oh, it tastes good. So he learns to lie.
It's so interesting, the different relationships, you know, the mother with talking about, you know, the words, they say the words, they read, they eat, and the father, you know, like a lot of guys, you know, don't talk.
Don't talk, just taste. Yeah. Yeah, talk is just the translation. You should have the experience first.
That's right.
And in some ways, that's the way his father is throughout the book, although his father needs to learn something about moderating in that sense. And the mother, of course, needs to take positions as the book goes on. So,
where do these characters come from?
Well, I don't really know. I think in some ways they started really with the metaphors of the foods that they ate and liked so much, and sort of the suggested culture out of which those foods came. And then part of what I enjoy so much about writing is sort of starting with some premises like that and you know, more and more fully drawing characters as they start acting and talking and being and learning about them really as they sort of reveal themselves to me as we go along. So a lot of it was just discovery, really. I don't come from a restaurant family, and although my mother was a wonderful cook and my father was a lover of good food, I don't really have that in my background so much. And I grew up in the Midwest, which was not a great place for food in the 1950s and 60s when I was growing up. So, you know, much of it is imaginative and almost fantasy about the way I wish food could be.
Interesting. Now, it's interesting. I wonder if when you were writing this book and then getting it published, if you thought it would ever be nominated for a literary food writing category of a cookbook contest. Has that occurred to you?
Oh, gosh, no. You know, to tell you the truth, I was a little nervous about writing a book that that focused so heavily on food.
Why?
In part because I felt like, well, there is this interest out there in food and in food writing right now. And I had, you know, read so much of it, wonderful stuff, M.F.K. Fisher and all the way to Calvin Trillin, one of my favorite food writers. And I was afraid that, that editors might have the same response that some of them did initially when we showed them the manuscript, which was, oh, well, we have a book like that coming out. In fact, my editor, Greg Michelson at Blue Hen, when he first started reading the book, called his co-editor and said, do we really need another food book? And his co-editor fortunately said, well, if it's good, yes. Of course, if you're enjoying it, don't worry about it. But they were almost working to make sure that the book was sort of viewed as a literary novel.
Mm-hmm.
And on the cover of the book, it says Secrets of the Teal Cafe, a novel.
Right.
You know, it doesn't say what the paperback is going to say, which is in bright red at the bottom, a novel with recipes.
Now, because, why is that? Because they found it successful as a novel?
Yeah, I think because, in part because the novel really got much more attention than a first novel usually gets. And I think it's because of the food. And that's in part because if a book editor didn't have the time or the space to review it, likely she or he would send it down to the food people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, I did get the book mentioned, not quite fully reviewed, but mentioned in the New York Times. But it wasn't in the New York Times book review. It was in a rather long article by a freelance food critic and writer named Regina Schrambling,
mm-hmm.
who wrote a little piece called Have You Eaten Any Good Books Recently? And she really liked the characters and liked the writing. She tried a couple of the recipes and loved one of them and not so much the other, and wrote, these recipes seem to be the best efforts of a college professor. But then she had noted that I was a college professor, and I am, so I didn't mind that one bit. But I am so pleased by the literary food writing nomination, just because I really tried hard to capture in language food. And one of the best compliments I got was from a cook friend of mine who said, you think about food the way I think about food. So, you know, that really resonated with me as one of the best things I could hear.
Yes. You are listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Thomas Fox Averill, author of Secrets of the Chill Cafe, published by Blue Hen Books. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Oh, boy, Blue Hen. You know, they're coming out with so many good books, and when this one landed on my doorstep, I was so pleased. How did you hook up with Blue Hen?
Well, I was really very lucky. I have a very nice and wonderful agent, Stephanie von Hirschberg, in New York, and she had read about the new imprint Blue Hen at Penguin Putnam and thought that that she ought to get in on the ground floor of that. They had not yet published any books, and in fact, mine was one of their first four to come out last year with the new imprint. And so she sent it to them, you know, fairly early on when they were looking to round out their list. And it was a long and hard sell in some ways, but we got it through. I guess my Blue Hen editor called my agent when he was about halfway through the book and said, I hope this book is still available.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we got really excited. And she said, oh, yes, it's available. And she was going on vacation for a week, and he said, well, I'll call you when the week's over. And she got back, and he called her and said, can't take the book. And then proceeded to talk to her for an hour about what he didn't like about the ending of the book, the last third especially.
Mm-hmm.
And she called and related the bad news and said, but you ought to talk to him because he's very smart. And he obviously likes your book. He's not just being critical. So I said, okay, I'll call him if it's okay with him. And I got his number and called him. And he talked to me for an hour about the book.
What did he like?
Well, what you know, the way it's written as a sort of false memoir almost. You know, mm-hmm. Wes looking back, he's someone's probably 50 years old, and he's now the proprietor of his own restaurant, and his father and mother are old, and they're retired. And he's kind of looking back in a way to his formative years and how he became the cook that he is and the restaurateur that he is. And so it had that sort of quality where it wasn't strictly chronological always. Yeah. It sort of jumps around in time. And what happened, I think, to me as a writer was that I had become a little bit mired in chronology in about the last 100 pages of my manuscript and had moved away from the Till Cafe and away from the food and gotten more into gardening and some horticultural therapy and some, you know, things like that I was interested in. And sort of I felt like, well, gee, I have to account for, you know, 25 more years. I better write this out. And he encouraged me just to let that go. And to stick with the parents, stick with the Till Cafe, stick with those unities that made the book sensual and magical, that the reader was used to. And he encouraged me to do that and then said, so what do you think you're going to do? And I said, well, I don't know, maybe we'll just fish with the same bait for a while. We like it. And there was this pause. And suddenly he said, Tom, I'm not trying to be rude, but you will not sell the book unless you rewrite it. And he said, I'm just telling you, this is what I do. I'm an editor. It's going to be very hard to sell it. And so he said, so what do you think? And I paused. And of course, this is what I tell my students all the time. You know, this would be a better story if. Mm-hmm. And this is what I do. I know my business. Please just try it. So I said to him, well, I'll try it. Will you be interested in seeing it if I try it? And he said, sure. So I tried it very quickly. Just showing him I could do it.
Overnight.
And within about a month and a half, we had sold the book to him.
So did you pretty much look at it with his eyes and see that the changes he wanted were good ones and it worked?
Yes. I came to agree with him wholeheartedly. You know, I think as writers we have that experience all the time where we know that something's not quite right, but we've got it as good as we can get it, and it's real easy to sort of stick with that as what has to be. But sometimes the minute someone really brings it up and says, look, this middle section's not working, or this scene does not help your book, we can kind of right away just let go and say, you're right, I was having problems with that myself. and I did, and I you know, rewrote it and rewrote the endings and kept the stuff that I thought was really, really working and some of the recipes that were working and just really let go without too much trouble the rest of it.
Now, so it had been rejected by other publishers?
Yeah, maybe 10 or 12.
Okay.
The usual.
The usual.
Yeah.
Well, you're so lucky that Blue Hen settled on it, because just their treatment of it and the way it looks and all that. Well, let's talk about it when we come back. We'll take a short break. And all of you out there, keep your radio on 88.9. We'll be right back with more Thomas Fox Averill and Secrets of the Till Cafe. Don't go away.
Thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it. it over one more time.
On Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM, broadcasting from the campus of the University of California, Irvine, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and the opinions that you hear on this show are those of me and my guest, Thomas Fox Averill, author of Secrets of the Chill Cafe, published by Blue Hen Books, and the music you just heard, that song that I play whenever I'm in the studio at this particular break, is by my other half, Brian Barrett, and he can be found somewhere playing in Orange County on any given night of the month. So anyway, more Thomas Fox Averill. Wanted to ask you about a quote that I read in an article written about you in your book. And that is, you said, "I think that I like cooking and gardening and writing and teaching all for the same reason, and that is you never know what you're going to get." Will you elaborate?
Well, yeah. You know, they're all things you do that you know, you have to nurture things along. You have to pay attention to the dailiness of them. You don't always know whether your efforts are going to bring success. You learn a lot from your mistakes in all of those things. And at the end of the day, you're usually very pleasantly surprised at how things grow towards you, your students and your words and your food and they're very satisfying pursuits, and I think that's why I've sort of led myself into a life of those things.
What has been the reaction of women and of men to this book?
Well, I've been pleasantly surprised at how both men and women seem to love the book. You don't always hear from the people who don't like it. I'll say that right away. You know, your friends read it, and if they don't like it, they usually shut up, which is all for the good, as I'm concerned. But I've had young women, old women, young men, and old men, you know, all tell me how much they enjoy the book, and some of them for lots of different reasons, and probably that's good that there are very different reasons for people to like the book. In other words, a lot of people feel very tenderly towards Wes, who's a young man in most of the book, and it's his coming of age, and he has to go through some fairly tough experiences and go through some of the stupidities of his parents, and then, of course, he goes through the stupidities that we all foist upon ourselves as young people. And a lot of people identify with him in the sense that he always he's like a plant. He's always growing towards the light, at least, even if he grows in sort of odd ways at different times. And I actually think that's one of the things that a lot of people have liked about the book, the fact that there are not really any villains in the book.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of missteps that people make, and there's a lot of intensity, and there's a lot of things that people do to hurt each other, but nobody's a bad person. And that's not because I'm just a sweet, hopeful, optimistic guy or something, but it's really because I made a decision to write a book that would remain appetizing.
Mm.
And since it's so much about food and about plants and about growing, that I wanted to give characters an opportunity to finally be their best and to sort of put their best on the table and have it be palatable. So each time I had a character that seemed to be moving, you know, towards self-destruction or towards darkness or whatever, I'd always think, well, what could bring them, what could change this somehow? And I found that as just a way of writing, it was kind of an interesting turnabout all the time. I would have the mother would have an affair with Pablito, and what would, you know, Pablito was in the dumps because he had left his wife after she miscarried, and it's a tough time for people. And then he starts his own restaurant, and then he has children, and then, you know, suddenly he's a different person again. And I think people have the opportunity to do that. So, there is a kind of warmth to the book that I think, but not a syrupy quality
not
to it.
At all.
So that it appeals to a lot of different sensibilities, and then a lot of men, to tell you the truth, just like it because they like hot food too. and that's fine because I totally understand that, and that was one of the pleasures of writing the book. Writing a book that has so much to do with hot, spicy food and with chili peppers, you know, I knew there would be certain scenes in there in which two men had to eat chili peppers together and see which one gave up first. And you know, certain scenes were almost obligatory for me to write out. So.
Now, when the Blue Hen editor suggested you change or work on the last third or so, did he at all suggest that you let go of the recipes, or was that just not a part of it?
No, that was never a part of his agenda. He liked the recipes, and he actually liked the footnotes, which was, I was really concerned that some editor would say, well, you can leave the recipes, but you can't have any footnotes. And I spent a lot of time researching that food. I was fond of those little footnotes.
Yeah, they're interesting. They're not what one would think of as footnotes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tried very hard to, you know, digest a lot of material in my research and to come up with sort of my own language for them and my own way of describing the foodstuffs of the New World, and to sort of be educational in the same way that Robert Englander at base is trying to educate people about these foods that were in the Western Hemisphere before Columbus. There were some things that I wrote that didn't make it into the book. I wrote little primer poems. You know, each letter of the alphabet had a little foodstuff that I had tried to sneak in twice past my editor, and both sides, you know, those things have got to go. And I gave them up pretty easily, although they were fun little ditties to write.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Thomas Fox Averill, author of Secrets of the Chill Cafe, published by Blue Hen. And that funny word is spelled T-S-I-L, so when you're looking it up and trying to locate this book, that's how you pronounce that word. Do you think it would have worked as well without the recipes? I mean, it's really, you know, the novel is pretty much the novel, and the recipes are wonderful additions, but how would it have been if you were forced, say, to get rid of them? Or would you have allowed yourself to be encouraged to get rid of them?
That's a tough question, and I'm glad I didn't have to confront it, to tell you the truth. As I said, I was almost ready to, if someone said, well, you don't need those footnotes, I'll just say, oh, I understand, because that's sort of written in a different language, and actually recipes are written in a different language than the first-person narration in the book. But to me, you have characters in this book who are very intense about food, who love food, or they're making a statement with their food. And for me, the recipes are almost inseparable from the characters. Each time there is a recipe, it usually does have to do with the narrative and with a particular character in the narrative. And I think I would miss it Also, that opportunity that people have to engage a book on that sensual level. As much as you write about food, there are people who simply buy cookbooks with the only intention of reading them, not even cooking out of them. They're a wonderful, almost fantasy. I read a lot of cookbooks, and I never try the food. I just read them and think, oh, that would be so good. Mm-hmm. Or I would adjust that to this, and, you know, I would do that. So I think there's a quality to, an imaginative quality to the recipes in there, a break from the narrative and an opportunity for the reader to almost be the character, because one of the things about writing recipes is that you do make the reader the character. You know, when it says preheat oven, that means you. You got to do it. So there's an entry in that second person of the recipe. There's an entry into the world of the book that, even if someone's not cooking, is a tangible entry to the book. And I think that's one reason we like those books with recipes. And I think that's one reason that that the editor said, yeah, you know, this is great. Leave them in. He didn't ever tell me to take them out, because mm-hmm. I think they do work that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, in the same article that I mentioned earlier about you, that you said that when you stalled on the narrative, you could jump to a recipe.
Mm-hmm. That was very true of this book, and one of the ways in which my writing process sort of changed. As I was writing this book, I did things differently than I'd ever done before, and that was I had a very clear outline of what I wanted to do and where I was going, for one thing. And it wasn't step-by-step or, you know, ABC kind of outline, but I knew where I was going. I knew what kinds of scenes I had to write. And I knew there were these odd tasks of writing recipes, writing footnotes, writing the restaurant reviews of the food critic, for example, and the little snippets that he writes. So there was always some other kind of writing to do, or some other scene to write. And I didn't write this book in chronological order at all. I would write one scene, and then I'd think, oh, I want to write that habanero challenge eating peppers scene. I'm going to do that one now and see how that works. And so I jumped all around in the writing, and I had a lot of travel time when I was writing the book, and I actually told some of the scenes to myself out loud in the car like two or three times on a two-hour trip. And then I would get home, and I'd pretty much know exactly what I was going to write down in the scene. So I did it much more scenically and out of order, and lots of different kinds of writing, because first person can get difficult to sustain over a long novel.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Why you chose the first person, and was there ever a question of it being in third person?
Yes, there was. I started it in first, and then wrote to my agent and said, I'm going to try it in third because I'm not sure I can sustain this voice. And she said, okay, try it. And I tried it, and I didn't like it any better. And then I finally settled on first when I could imagine Wes being that grown-up person writing about, not necessarily chronologically, writing about his growing up. And almost taking the tone of the memoir. In it, he knows things that he really wouldn't have known when he was three, but he's remembering the time when he was three, and, you know, as we all do, we have the stories that our parents told us about what we did when we were three or whatever. So I don't have the character be the consciousness of the age he is as he's going through scene by scene. He has this one consciousness that informs the whole book.
When did you settle on that?
Oh, fairly early on. I wrote the book over about a 12-month period, which is very fast for me. But as I said, I'd been thinking about it and cooking it for a long time. So I was very well prepared to write the book. I'd even traveled to Mexico and had done a little bit of cooking there. and done a language school, and I'd taken Spanish, and you know, I was very prepared. But so I was working for a couple months, and then I switched over and tried the first 50, 60 pages in third, and then moved back to first, and just went with that for the rest of the writing of it.
Interesting. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot lately. Just got back from a conference in New York, a group I belong to, the American Society of Journalists and Authors, and most of the people I know through that group are journalists, and so are thinking of ways to tell stories. Usually, if it's in any sort of narrative form, it's narrative nonfiction, and so I'm thinking a lot about what we do with our stories in terms of, are they fiction or are they narrative nonfiction, especially when you are taking something, say, from your life and dealing with material that you've lived, perhaps not entirely, but that's there, and what you do with that material. So I guess I'm wondering, I mean, your story is obviously fictional. What do you tell writers, though, as a teacher, dealing with material that, say, they've lived and they're trying to figure out what to do with it? Do they do it as narrative nonfiction? Do they will they have more freedom maybe if they do it as a novel, do it as a story? What do you think?
Well, I think it's really a question for most writers of distance, how much distance there is on the material. I sometimes think you need a certain amount of distance in order to have the story be a story and not be yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The reader wants to engage language and wants to engage the story, doesn't want just to engage the author's feelings about something. And so sometimes even, you know, trying to turn something into a piece of fiction and then to write it in the first person, you feel all this confusion as you read. I've read a lot of stories like that from my students, and I know they're writing from their personal experience, and I know they don't have much distance on their personal experience. And at some point or another, it has the quality of either preaching or of anger or of some emotion that the writer hasn't quite figured out. And, of course, the goal in writing, I think, is always to make the reader experience the story and not experience the writer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want someone thinking about me when they're reading Secrets of the Till Cafe. I want them to be thinking about Wes. But, you know, even in some really fine novels, you'll run across things that you think, oh, that's the writer putting that in there, some strong opinion or some political something or some whatever. And it, or that's the writer's research, you know. And you sort of balk at that because you want the experience yourself. So I try to get students and writers to think about, you know, how can they make it a story for the reader? And sometimes that means switching to third person. Sometimes that means doing it very factual.
Hmm.
You know, being very objective. Early on in the project, when I had written just 40 pages worth of random scenes or something, and she really liked it, but she wanted an outline. She wanted to know where it was going. And so I sat down and wrote a sort of chapter-by-chapter summary of which characters were going to be in what scene, what time frame, what was going to be the food stuff in it, what was the central metaphor of it, those kinds of things. There was a lot that I didn't know. And writing is in large part discovery of who the characters are and what's underneath what you've imagined as a plot in a plot outline. So there was a lot of discovery and a lot of surprises and a lot of things that I still don't quite understand when they came up, and a lot of the intricacies of the plot and of the secrets. I knew in general what the secrets were going to be, but I didn't know in particular how I was going to get them down or get them out. And that's the fun part of writing, is even if you have best laid plans, things always go astray. and usually in a way that's much better than you can think of when you're trying to write an outline or a plot summary or or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I also showed the work a lot to friends and to my agent, and found that I'd sometimes been very private about my work, but with this I thought, very consciously I thought, I've written two novels that have never been accepted. I mean, this is my first novel, but like most first novelists, that doesn't count the two that are under the bed.
Right.
And I took to heart something that I read about Picasso once, demonstrating how he worked with a young student, and at the end of his work session, he crumpled all of his sketches up and threw them in the trash, and the student said, "Good God, that was wonderful." I said, "How can you do that? Don't you love them?" And Picasso said, "Of course I love them." He said, "But I don't buy art myself." I mean, you know, he doesn't sell his own art to himself. You can't sell your art to yourself,
mm-hmm.
you know. And in a way, I felt like, I'm tired of writing books that only I like. And so I did show him a lot. And it's not that I felt like I needed to write by consensus or by committee. It's more that I wanted to write something that really was for a reader and not just for myself. So I took seriously things that people told me and that my agent told me, and moved in that direction. It's always my material, but I enjoyed the sort of collaborative effort that I had with the book.
Hmm. That's an interesting point, writing for the reader and not yourself. And
yeah.
It's interesting how to imagine what this book might have been had you written it for yourself and not for the reader. Interesting.
Yep.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Thomas Fox Averill, author of Secrets of the Chill Cafe, published by Blue Hen Books. How do you, as a literary writer, keep the marketplace at bay? You know, there's so much bad news that you can pay attention to if you allow yourself to, how it's so difficult to sell fiction, how this, how that. How do you keep it away from you so you can actually still create?
Well, I really feel that I don't have any choice but to write what I can write. And I think whenever you conceive of something, especially something as long as a novel, you're always taking a chance. I mean, whether you're writing something that you think will hit the marketplace just right, or whether you're just writing another weird thing that you do, I really don't have any confidence that I'll be part of the marketplace, I guess, except because that's something you can't control. I mean, you just can't control the world of taste in the marketplace, or of who's buying what, or, you know, all of those things are just way beyond your control. And I think the way I keep thoughts and worries about that at bay is to just stay focused on the language itself and the story potential, and making writing for me as fun as possible, as interesting as possible.
Hmm. Well, we have a minute left, and I wonder if you have any last words, pearls of wisdom for the writers listening. And I think we just lost him. I think something very weird just happened to our phone system, and he's gone. This happens now and then. Well, fortunately, we only had a minute left, and he is Thomas Fox Averill, author of Secrets of the Chill Cafe, and the book is a wonderful one. Beautiful cover. Absolutely beautiful cover. I know I talk about covers a lot on this show, but books are, you know, it's the whole package. It's how it looks. It's how it feels. It's how it reads, and it's nice when you have it all in one package, you know. So, anyway, if you want to find out more about it, you can always go to penguinputnam.com, and I think Blue Hen Books has sort of a place that you can hook into this book. And what else? If you want to be on the mailing list for this show, you can email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net or visit my website, writersonwriting.com. And I would like to leave you with a quote by Sophia Loren, who said, "Everything you see, I owe to spaghetti." I love that quote. This is 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, California. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and thank you so much for listening.